Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to New Books and Music, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Bradley Morgan, and I am joined today by my guest, Stevie Van Zandt. Stevie is a musician, writer, producer, actor, radio host, and activist. He is best known as the guitarist of Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band and the lead member of Little Steven and the Disciples of Soul. He is also known for his acting work on The Sopranos and Lilyhammer, his radio work as the host of Little Steven's Underground Garage, and as well for his tireless devotion to education with TeachRock.org. Stevie's latest book is Unrequited Infatuations and is published by Hachette Books. Stevie, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure, my friend.
So for those who may be unaware of your work or of your book, please share with us what it is, what it's about.
Well, it's about 400 pages. Let's see, what's it about? It's about my crazy life. And the first half of the book is kind of a local kid makes it to the top of rock and roll, which is a great story in itself. But second half of the book, I think, gets a little bit more interesting, a little bit more broad in terms of the themes, and starts to include, I think, things that people can relate to, whether they're, you know, in the music business or not, having to do with a search for identity and a search for purpose in life, having that first dream sort of disappear for whatever reason. I think most people at some point in their lives hit the wall, you know, or might hit the wall in terms of their fantasy life, or their, you know, what they imagine their life to be, and suddenly it's not working out or whatever, and now what, you know? So I think, you know, I'm hoping it's encouraging and inspirational in a sense of basically when I left the E Street Band, I didn't just change jobs. My life ended. So the basic theme is if you can find a way to keep going and stay alive and not succumb to, you know, self-pity and drugs and drinking and suicide, all of which I considered, you will find that destiny maybe is not done with you yet. And you know, you may find that in my case, everything I've accomplished basically happened after I thought my life was over. So, you know, I'm hoping that can be some kind of motivational sort of idea.
I think so. So about your childhood in New Jersey, you write, "We were the second generation of rock and roll kids, which meant that we were the second generation able to play records in the privacy of our own rooms." Can you talk about the impact that had on you and what those early records were?
Yeah, I mean, the main impact would have happened really for the first generation, for the, you know, the pioneers in the 50s were quite wild. I mean, they were wild to the point of novelty acts, really, but novelty acts that were half distraction and half scary, very, very scary for the parents of that 50s generation. mostly because of the success of the black artists. You know, there was still a very, very, we were very, very much a segregated country, and rock and roll was associated with black artists mostly. You know, Elvis Presley would obviously change that, but he was very influenced by black music, and that was obvious by the way he performed. And so this became a threat, to the parents of the day, and society in general. Very, very, you know, there's all kinds of stories about, you know, people breaking those records and police raiding live concerts. It was really quite a scary time for society, because it was the beginning of shaking society up in a good way, and the beginning of integration, basically, which unfortunately continues today. We're still struggling with it today, which is embarrassing, to be frank. But anyway, at that point, you know, at first, all of these performers, they all had some shtick. You know, they all had a sort of a novelty kind of shtick, which helped make it more palatable at first. You know, Chuck Berry, you know, the moves he made, you know, Bo Diddley, the moves he made, Elvis Presley, you know, you name it. They all had something going for them in terms of it wasn't just music. You know, it was the way they dressed. It was the way they performed. And my thinking of this was, you know, in those days, the record player at first was a piece of furniture in the middle of the room. In order to get that past your parents in those days, you know, they had to kind of approve of what you're listening to. And I don't think Little Richard, you know, would have survived that test, or Jerry Lee Lewis, or any of them. You know, I think at some point the parents would just have shut that down. And there's a great book about all of this. I think it's called 45 RPM. I should know the name of it. It's terrific. I think it's still available. I hope so. But anyway, so they for various reasons, and it's a really an interesting story having to do with trying to give you the brief version, but basically having to do with the unions boycotting, you know, worried about radio playing records because they thought that was going to put live music out of business. There was a whole concern about the industry being destroyed by radio, oddly enough, and so they started making 45s. With the more controversial and edgy types of music, this rock and roll, this new rock and roll thing, blues, you know, country, even, you know, and along with those little 45s, which were made basically so they wouldn't break into jukeboxes, you know, because the old stuff would break, the old shellac, whatever it was, you know, the 78s, you know, Once they fell on the jukebox, it would break. And so they made these plastic vinyl singles. And along with them, it's a long story short here, along with those little singles, they made little portable record players for kids. This is all for kids, by the way, mostly for kids. And again, that was the novelty item of rock and roll was at play there. So the kids could bring these little portable up into their room and play whatever they wanted. And I think that's how rock and roll survived, because without that, I honestly don't think it would have gotten past the living room, you know. So there was that was the beginning of technology, you know, helping out the art form. And it was the beginning, literally the naissance of what I consider to be the renaissance of the 60s. So we inherited all that. You know, we took all that for granted. We didn't know anything about that. We all had little record players in our rooms. And we all, you know, played the singles for ourselves and occasionally wore them out. That's how much we played them. And so we inherited rock and roll as an institution. Certainly by the time the Beatles and the British Invasion really stage their coup d'etat on the charts. And suddenly rock and roll wasn't just a cult, another cult. It became mainstream. Rock and roll became the mainstream because of the British invasion.
Okay. So while you're listening to these records, you're also forming your musicianship chops, and you start a lot of the bands early on in high school. And while you're creating those bands, you write about just diving in and learning from the experience, and this would be a methodology you would adopt throughout the rest of your career. Can you share with us what those early band experiences were like and what you learned that you still apply to this day?
I kind of divide the music career, if you will, into three stages. And that probably hasn't changed really. You had the teenage years, and then you had the bar band years, and then you have the get into the business. You're in the business now. You're in the music business, and you're signed by a record company. You're making records, and you're doing all that. The teenage years were actually the most fun. Now, it's a shame because you don't really realize that at the time. You don't really you don't enjoy it as much at the time. But looking back on it now, the wonderful part of those teenage years was rock and roll was so new that no adult even pretended to understand it. There wasn't anybody going to tell you what to play. They had no idea what you were doing, And if you wanted to, if you wanted to have a rock and roll band for some reason, play your dance or play your beach club, you had to go to kids. There was no such thing as a 25-year-old playing rock and roll, even in those days. They were the wedding bands. They were the previous generation bands. You had to go to 15, 16-year-old kids to actually have some kind of semblance of this new rock and roll thing going on, So it was a wonderful, wonderful, liberating, you were completely free to do whatever you wanted, again, it's a shame we didn't really appreciate it at the times, because you start to appreciate it when you get to the bar band years, and that completely changed. The opposite was true. Now the bars are telling you you have to play the top 40, whatever the top 40 hit singles were. And by the 70s, the top 40 was not very cool. It was extremely cool in the 60s. In my opinion, the evolution of our art form actually was mostly the pop singles, the pop rock singles of the 60s, which led to the ultimate zenith, which was the Who's Pete Townshend's Tommy. But basically, the hit singles of the 60s were still, to me, the highest evolution of the art form. Give me a 3-minute Motown single, and or a Beatles single, or a Stones single. So many of these great songs were hits. Certainly makes you a bit nostalgic for those days, because hasn't been a rock and roll hit, I don't think, on the charts for 20 or 30 years now. But they were all hits back then. I mean, Have You Seen Your Mother, Baby by the Rolling Stones was a hit single. Crazy things. So the early years were kind of fun, and man, there was work all the time. We were still in high school, so you're playing weekends and beach clubs, high school dances, VFW halls, teenage nightclubs were built for our generation. Nobody saw that before or since. We were such a lucky generation. I call us the luckiest generation. Literally, Latin Devu was built for us, and you had to be under 18 to get in, those kind of things. So we had a wonderful sort of freedom right up until the end of the 60s. And then when drugs began, people started, when marijuana got to the suburbs, everything started to shut down and change and get weird. And soon people would stop dancing to rock and roll, which we brought back in the mid-70s with Southside Johnny and Asbury Jukes in our residency in Asbury Park and the Stone Pony. That 1973, 74, 75 period when things had stopped, people had stopped dancing to rock and roll basically by then, and were just getting stoned and sitting down and listening to it. You know, it was a whole different sensibility. But in the bars, you know, they were usually 5 or 10 years behind, which worked out to be a good thing actually for us, because being a dance band, I think, prepared us to be a terrific concert band. And that's one reason why there's very few great concert bands now, because they didn't go through that dance band period where you had to make people dance or you didn't work. And we went through it. The Beatles went through it. The Rolling Stones went through it. The Who, the Kinks, the Dave Clark Five, they all had to be dance bands at some point. And I think that strengthens your performance ability.
It's interesting to see how music and rock and roll had changed from the 60s and 70s in terms of style, how you consume it. But you say that in the 70s, it was the worst time in history to record. And I wanted to know what you meant by that and how that affected your ability to work in a studio.
Yeah, it was just funny. An awkward decade generally. There were some exceptions to the rule. But basically, as it became an industry, okay, it wasn't really an industry until the 70s. Up until then, it was just the Wild West. But the Wild West, with really great records being made, the old way, you know, the only way they knew. If you go back and listen to basically every record from the 50s and 60s, you know, sound great, you know. And suddenly, 24-track recording came in, you know, multi-track recording came in, which gave you a lot more freedom, but you know, more bad things happened than good from multi-track recording, in my opinion. I mean, the beginning of the trouble started with stereo, to be honest. You know, it's just completely unnatural and made people lazy and made people less qualified to do what they do. You know, it just made things easier in a technical way, which wasn't a positive thing, actually, in the end. But anyway, suddenly the engineers became more important because you were recording multiple tracks, and so mixing became a thing. You know, mixing wasn't that big a thing when you're recording 2-track, you know, or even 4 tracks. You know, you put 4 faders up and you're done, you know, or in the beginning, you know, 2, you know, whatever. When it's 24 and then 48 tracks, you know, suddenly the engineer has got to be has a different job, you know, in a way. And so the engineers became more important, and so they wanted more control. And suddenly, you know, leakage, you know, one instrument leaking into another microphone from the band being recorded with just a couple of mics like the old days, that was something that became uncool. They wanted to be able to control every single instrument and every single track. So they started to pad everything, rugs and towels and pillows in the bass drum and, you know, tape on the drums and all of this stuff, you know, and close miking. And so they basically, the concept was, you know, take all the excitement out of the recording and then we'll put it back in the mix. I mean, it sounds ridiculous and it is ridiculous. And that's what was going on throughout the 70s, really, until we figured out how to fix that, which was, well, let's go back to what worked in the beginning, which was let's find drummers who know how to tune their drums. Let's realize that the harder you hit a drum, like in the heavy hard rock way, the smaller the drum sounds. Okay, because the early drummers were all jazz drummers, right? They're all, and if they weren't jazz drummers, they were being trained by jazz drummers, all of them. You know, if you took a lesson, you were taking a lesson from a jazz drummer, and they played with their hands, with their palm up, you know, which was easier and had a snap to it, and really Ringo was the first one I think to play with hands down, but most of those guys were playing, you know, and the microphones were overhead, so we realized why everything sounded great. And we fixed it on Hungry Heart. Was the first time we fixed everything. We actually got a great drum sound. It was because, you know, they were using the room sound. You know, it was the room that mattered, not the close mic, which is just, you know, sounds like a stick hitting a pillow, you know, not very exciting. But if you walk into a room and a band's playing, you're going to hear what we realized is the room sound. And so we discovered that, and it was a huge revelation for us. This is 1979, 80, 81, whatever. And then, of course, after years and years and years of figuring this out and struggling, you know, 6 months later, they invented sampling. And, you know, all that research was completely useless, because now you could push a button and have a terrific snare drum sound. But before that, you actually had to earn it. And so, you know, those things were corrected basically by the 80s, you know, but in the 70s, a lot of records just didn't sound as good as they should. Yeah, one exception certainly was Led Zeppelin, who, you know, Jimmy Page was an absolute genius producer, and I don't know why he didn't produce more. It's a shame, because he's absolutely an absolute genius. I mean, you listen to that first Led Zeppelin album, it just keeps getting better, and they did the thing in like 2 weeks. But they found out, you know, they were, and you know, of course, John Bonham, the drummer, was probably making suggestions as well, but they ended up recording him in a stairwell and, you know, using room sound, in other words.
Well, it's really interesting. We talk about recording in the 70s because you have a very vast analytical musical mind, which I think is fascinating. And you mentioned Hungry Heart, which brought up my next question, that after this, you know, during the 70s, you're working with Bruce, getting a lot of experience and success from that. And then when you record The River, there was a quote I found fascinating. You write, "A record ain't a movie. It's a fine line how sparse you can make something without the visual assistance before you lose an audience." And I want to know, what are the challenges involved with not losing an audience when recording an album?
You know, it's a little, you know, trying to summarize these ideas. A record is a few different elements to a record. You have the composition, you have the arrangement, you know, you have the performance, you have the sound, and they all have to be really working together. The craft of arrangement, I've always found the most fascinating and the most interesting and the most fun. And the one craft that has sort of disappeared up until, I don't know when, mid-70s maybe, there was always an arranger at the sessions. That was an essential part of the mix, part of the crew, you know. Now the lucky guys had, you know, like the Beatles obviously had a George Martin, who was both a producer and an arranger, but that was rare, actually. You know, most producers had arrangers at the sessions, and so ADD. My ADD was, you know, way before it became fashionable. And kind of works for the newer generations, you know, who made ADD, you know, a simple zeitgeist change. You know, really, it was just I would get bored quickly listening to a song, and so I want something interesting to happen in the second verse, You know, I want something interesting to happen when the chorus comes. I want to surprise people with a bridge. I want to surprise people with a solo in a different key. I am the king of modulation. I will modulate a solo almost every single time, which means changing the key. Why? Just to surprise you and keep your ears awake, you know, as you're listening. And so you have a dynamic force of going on within the composition. You know, the composition can begin with just an acoustic guitar and sing, and you sing a song, and that's a song. That's a composition. Okay, but it's not a record. You know, a record involves these other things. You know, the arrangement and the sound, and like I said, we struggled a bit. You know, we had a little bit of a difference of opinion between me and the other two producers, which were Bruce Springsteen and John Landau. They liked the more simplified, stoic, you know, sort of spare, in their minds, more cinematic approach. In a more extreme way, you know. So I would always just be arguing, yeah, that has its place, and sometimes that works great, but most of the time not. Most of the time, you wanna keep people interested on more than a, and it can be subliminal. It doesn't have to be really something that you know, way out front. Just another instrument coming in a subtle way that keeps the thing dynamically, you know, emotionally, keeping you emotionally engaged. You know, it was just a matter of it's a matter of opinion, really. That this is not a right or wrong thing. It was really a matter of, you know, whatever you preferred. But that was a part of the artistic, you know, part of the art form is making those kinds of decisions. You know, how produced to make something. You know, when does the arrangement help a composition, and when does it start to dilute it or confuse it, or you know, these kinds of decisions you're making every few seconds. You know, as I say, a masterpiece is a thousand good guesses. You know, and I stand by that.
Well, the album came out, you know, it was a very successful album, and when you're touring for the album in Europe with Bruce, at around this time you meet in a German kid that changed your perception about politics. Before, you weren't really interested in politics, but now meeting this kid, you were, and it set you on a path that you're still on today. Share us what happened with that meeting.
Yeah, we were touring Europe for the first time, really. We had done a very brief tour for Born to Run, but the real tour came two albums later with The River, and we finally had enough success to really go to Europe, and I'm so glad we did. It became an extraordinarily important part of our career. We had a wonderful genius agent, Frank Barcelona, who insisted we go to Europe when it was not a regular thing to do. People were not automatically going to Europe in those days. Many bands didn't, you know. Which is why years later, you know, you could see Van Halen opening for Bon Jovi, which was, for an American, an extremely bizarre, you know, thing to witness. But it was because Van Halen didn't go to Europe and Bon Jovi did, because they had the same agent as we did, Frank Barcelona. But anyway, so we're touring, and a kid comes up to me in Germany and says, "Why are you putting missiles in my country?" And I had no idea what he was talking about. I guess he was talking about NATO, which I didn't know anything about at the time. And I was like, I don't know, no idea what you're talking about. But it just stayed with me for some reason. For weeks, it would keep the brief little encounter would just keep recurring, you know, recurring. And finally, you know, I'm a little bit slow. I'm more than a little bit slow. It finally hit me. Oh my God, this kid's. Well, you know, once you're overseas, you know, people don't look at you necessarily as just a guitar player or. Or, you know, a Democrat or a Republican, suddenly I realized that they look at you as an American, you know? And I was like, wow, I'm an American. You know, a little embarrassing for that to occur to somebody who's 30 years old. But, you know, I was like, this never occurred to me before, you know? It's not the kind of thing that's going to, you know, occur to you in New Jersey, but overseas, you know, a whole different perspective. And suddenly I'm like, wow, if I'm an American, what does that mean? What does that mean? Do I have some kind of obligations or responsibilities or what does that mean? And so I began this journey of self-education about what that means. And I was like, well, you know, if we live in a democracy, which we really don't, but we're close enough, you know, we are responsible for what our government does. So I guess I am putting missiles in this kid's country. And I made me wonder, what else am I doing? And what else is being done in my name? So I started studying our foreign policy since World War II and was quite shocked to actually find out we were not the heroes of democracy. I thought we were. And by the way, my father was a ex-Marine Goldwater Republican. So, you know, I grew up with that that context. And I was actually quite shocked to find out that we were supporting a lot of dictators around the world you know, not doing the right thing. So I decided once I started my solo so-called career, just a year or two later, I thought that would be my thing, you know, because growing up in the 60s, as I did, everybody had to have a very specific identity, you know, and especially in the 60s, what I literally refer to as literally the Renaissance period. Come the 70s, it was a fragmentation. I talk about the fragmentation that happened in the early 70s, and the hybrids would begin. You know, you weren't going to have as original artists again, but even the hybrids had an originality to them. And that's why the Jukes we ended up kind of creating our own little genre of rock meets soul by having rock guitar with horns, you know. So that was our particular hybrid. So you had to have an identity, and I thought, well, if I'm going to make some solo records, I don't think the world needs, you know, love songs from an ex-sideman. I'll be the political guy. I'm into politics at that point. I'm into learning about myself, learning about how the world works, and I'm going to write about it, you know? And so I outlined 5 albums right away with different themes and sub-themes, and then I would then write the records according to the themes that I had laid out. And, you know, and I learned a lot about myself and about the world through the 80s. And then come 1989, I had learned what I wanted to learn. I had said what I wanted to say. And I just felt, you know, I kind of did my rock star. I lived my rock star fantasy out, and I no longer really, you know, I was like, I don't really feel like being a rock star anymore. You know, I'm gonna try and figure something else out, and I didn't figure it out really for 7 years after that. I just literally walked my dog and then until David Chase called and said, you know, do you want to be an actor? And I said, well, I got nothing better to do, so let me try that.
Well, while you were creating this five album arc and exploring the political side of your music and lyricism, you weren't just talking the talk, you were walking the walk. You got really engaged in politics, going to Central America to observe what was happening there. And while this is happening, the apartheid situation is worsening in South Africa, and there's discussions about a boycott. And you write in your book that your thought was to hotwire the existing boycott model, and this results in Sun City. Can you share with us the process of putting that album together, and what were the challenges you faced while doing that?
Yeah, it was just part of the... I made a list of all the conflicts in the world when I started to do my research and start to write my solo records. And there was, like, I think 44 or so conflicts in the world, one of which was in South Africa. But out of all the conflicts, I really had difficulty finding out what was really going on down there. It was a bit mysterious. You know, there was rumors, or, you know, conventional wisdom said there were reforms going on in the government. And it wasn't really an issue in America, by the way. You know, you'd hear from time to time somebody say something, you know, Harry Belafonte would say something, or you know, Randall Robinson or Stevie Wonder, you know, somebody would mention it. But it wasn't an issue. And you know, there was no movement, really. There was a very vague, you know, sort of disinvestment movement, which would eventually migrate to the colleges. And, you know, it was only in a very subtle and ineffective way. So I went down there. I went down there twice in, I guess it was 84. And just started learning about it. And at that point, I went from artist journalist, if you will, which would have been my first two albums. I started to get engaged, you know, I got engaged. And I really, I really remember the moment I got engaged, actually. I mean, I was in a taxi cab, and a guy, a black guy, stepped off the curb, and a taxi driver really swerved to hit him, you know, and he had to jump back, and just missed him, you know, and he was like, you know, fucking kafir, you know, which is their word for nigger. And I was like, did I just, you know, did I just see that? Did that just happen? You know, and it was such a shock to me that I just said, let me out of the cab, and I was like, whoa, this is beyond reform. You know, this is, these guys got to go. You know, and I had done a lot of interviews with a lot of people, and I started to realize the depth of the racism went all the way to the church. You know, and once you start once you start defending or justifying racism by, you know, biblical passages, you got a real serious problem. You know, you got something that's so deep that it ain't getting fixed. It ain't fixing itself, you know? So I realized they got to go. There's no reforms going on here. It's bullshit. And so I sat down and I said, you know, okay, how do I bring a government down? You know, that's something new, you know? And at that point, you know, I went from artist journalist to artist journalist activist, you know, in with the South Africa thing. And I just said, you know, well, the sports boycott is very effective. The home run is the economic boycott, which will cut off the banks, and therefore they will have to change. What's in between sports boycott and economic boycott? The cultural boycott. Okay, so we'll focus on that, which is perfectly appropriate since we are cultural, you know, in music. And I picked this resort that They were disguising and saying it was in a different country. Very, very briefly, they had learned from our Indian reservations and decided to return the black population to their so-called tribal homelands, which was really just a lie, a method for their plan, and their plan was get all the black people out of South Africa proper, you know, out of Johannesburg and Pretoria and all the main cities, bring them back to their tribal lands, you know, and South Africa was not very tribal except for the Zulu, and then get them all out, declare those homelands independent countries, and then bring all the black people back as immigrant labor, and then declare South Africa as a democracy. You know, this way the black people won't vote, and they weren't voting, by the way. That was the whole problem. You know, you had whatever it was, 24, 25 million black people and 3 million white people, and the black people weren't allowed to vote. So they would declare South Africa a democracy, and you know, that was the plan. And one of these so-called homelands was Maputswana, which was where this Sun City Resort was. And they would overpay people to play this Sun City Resort. I mean overpay, like hundreds of thousands of dollars per week. In those days, that was real money. In order to violate the United Nations boycott. You know, but they were saying, you're not violating the boycott. Don't worry, you're playing a different country. You know, but of course, that was a lie. So we thought, well, let's expose that lie that they're playing a different country and therefore expose the homeland policy and therefore give the people an understanding of what the apartheid system actually means. You know, that sort of divisiveness, that dividing, you know, that concept of division. So we use, so that's what we did. We used the Sun City Resort, and you know, we just said to the music world, don't stop playing Sun City, no matter what they offer you. And they never really saw us coming. You know, we kind of just snuck up on the world in a way. You know, suddenly. We do the song, and it was four of us. Very importantly, there was four of us, and each one of the four of us, any one of us missing would have been a whole different story. I connected with Danny Schechter, who basically publicized the whole thing through his own, you know, rebellious genius. Arthur Baker gave us his studio and his phone book. I mean, most of the album is Arthur Baker's phone book. And then Hart Perry came in and videotaped it. And the reason why that was important was because no radio station would play it. We a couple stations would play it, but that's it. That was it. It was ironically too black for white radio and too white for black radio. So we had our own, you know, little bit of apartheid in America, which continues to this day. But the only way people actually heard the song was by the video. I had a meeting with MTV and with BET, the black network, and luckily and thankfully, they played it. It wasn't obvious. It wasn't an obvious thing to play. You know, it was not an issue. You know, so you had to explain the issue to people. And even some of the artists that came on, I had to explain the issue to. Because, in fact, I went to the Senate and explained it to the Senate with Bill Bradley at the time. You know, that's how obscure it was. I mean, I had to point out, I had to point out to the Senate where South Africa was, you know. I said, well, there's two hints in the name, but okay. And anyway, so we were able to get such publicity because the home run, again, was going to be eventually there was going to be a disinvestment, you know, an economic legislation to cut them off. And that was, we knew that was the whole point of this exercise. And we knew when it got to Ronald Reagan's desk that he would veto it. All right, because it was the unholy trinity of Reagan, Thatcher, and Kohl, UK and Germany, all supporting the apartheid system, you know. And so we had to raise the consciousness of America to the point where miraculously we would find a way to override a Reagan veto, which had never been done. And so we were able to do that. We got to the congresspeople's kids, and suddenly the kids are coming home asking their congressmen and senators, you know, "Wait, daddy, mommy, what's this South Africa thing?" You know, and the legislation came up, and Reagan vetoed it, and we overrode the veto. Just to show you what a different world it was, it was overridden with Republican votes. Okay, there's Republicans defending the right for black people to vote, okay, in the 80s. You know, now the Republicans are doing everything they can to stop black people from voting in America. So a very different world.
Yeah, absolutely. With the rise of Christian nationalism happening, it makes me think about, if you were to do something like a Sun City today, so not to show my age, but Sun City is older than me, but I know that it was impactful, and I grew up in a world where I knew it was impactful and had experienced, you know, not personally any South African issues, but I see how that music activism had an impact. And so I'm thinking, how would you have done Sun City differently? Not how you would have done it differently, but how you would have adapted that model to 2022 if you were to do it today.
It couldn't be done. We were very fortunate to do it when we did it. These days, there are so many problems going on, and the fragmentation of our society is such that half the country, no matter what you do, and I mean literally no matter what you do, we couldn't get half the country to agree that a pandemic was a problem, okay? We can't get half the country to agree that the environment is about to destroy the planet, okay? And frankly, it's actually too late. You know, we may salvage some of it, but we're not going to salvage all of it. We're it's too late. All right, we have blown this one, and it's an emergency. It's an emergency with the environment. It was an emergency with the pandemic, and half the country refuses to acknowledge it. I mean, so if you can't get people to agree on a disease that's going to kill you, or you know, half the world's on fire, you're not going to get people to support some foreign countries' problems. Well, I mean, look at Ukraine. You know, one of the most regretful, embarrassing moments of my life. If I live to be 200 years old, I will remember our cowardice being bullied by this son of a bitch, you know, pretending he's going to blow up the world with nukes. What? We bought that? You know, 30 fucking countries bought that bullshit. He's a scam artist. He learned from Trump. He's watching Trump, his buddy. You know, Trump scammed his way, conned his way all the way to the presidency. He figures out, why shouldn't I attack Ukraine? Look at how weak these people are. This guy tried to overthrow the government. He's still playing golf. Well, I should be afraid of them? No. I'm going to attack Ukraine, and I'm going to say, I'll push the nuclear button if you try and stop me. And 30 countries said, oh, okay, you know, just don't go into France, and we'll let you massacre a fucking country while on TV every day, you know, a new reality show. Let's watch Ukraine get massacred, you know. I've never been so sick in my life. I never felt so bad and so embarrassed to be an American, you know, as watching us, you know, stand back and watch another country get slaughtered for, you know, it's just a shame.
So over the last 40 years, you have found many ways to still be an activist, and your latest foundation is teachrock.org. I want to know what are some of the biggest challenges within education you've become aware of since founding Teach Rock and how you're addressing those with the organization.
We've had remarkable success and virtually no hurdles, no problems, which surprised me a little bit. Because, you know, nothing we're doing now is political at all. You know, it's strictly the integration of arts into the basic curriculum, and we have found that by the integration of arts into the curriculum, not as an after school thing, not as an extra class, but literally infusing, integrating art into math, into science, you know, into technology, into engineering. We found it's much more effective, and the kids have a great time. The students have a much better time. The teachers have a much better time. We have enormous success with this thing, And you know, it's basically three things. It's the integration of arts into the DNA of our public school system, because a lot of it got cut out through the No Child Left Behind legislation, which was just misconceived. The second thing was creating a methodology for this generation. Well, like I say, it's no longer. ADD is no longer a disorder. It is simply the new reality. So how do you capture students' attention and keep it in this world where you can get any answer you want on your device in 30 seconds? You know, so we call it teaching in the present tense, teaching in a way that gives them something they can use now, because it's all about right now. And then the third thing, long term, we're hoping to affect the dropout rate, you know, increase the graduation rate out of high school, because it's a scandal. I mean, it's intolerable. We're talking incredibly, you know, 45-50% in the poor neighborhoods, and then half of them end up in the judicial. You know, system, in crime of some kind, you know, so that's just, that, you know, how do we call ourselves civilized and live with those kind of things? I don't know. So we're hoping in the long run, you know, it's statistics show if a kid likes one single class or one single teacher, they'll come to school. So we want to be that class. We want to be the fun class that uses music. So we licensed a bunch of music, a bunch of videos worldwide for free. We offer it to teachers for free. We have over 50,000 teachers doing it, and dozens of partner schools now adopting it, and so it's really been surprisingly easy. We just have to scale it right now. You know, that's our problem. You know, getting enough investment. You know, people donations, and you know, and I do what I can to increase the donations. But you know, the more donations, the more, because we have to have teachers teaching the teachers, you know, how to integrate it. So it takes a bit of money, you know, to do that. But we've been doing, you know, I didn't want to take any government money. I didn't want to take any grants that involve people having an opinion. You know, I had a very specific idea here, a very specific concept that I didn't want diluted, you know. So we've been doing it all with private money. And hopefully we'll continue to do it that way. But it's been really an interesting experiment that I think is working quite well.
What has been some great advice you've gotten over the years that have shaped your activism?
Activism? I think you grow naturally into it a little bit. You know, I don't think that people have to be told necessarily. Although it's nice when there's really enlightened parents telling their kids, give something back, you know, share your knowledge, your success, your share your wisdom. We're all connected, you know. I mean, it's nice to be taught that early, if you can, if it can be, because we are all connected. But I think in some ways, if you're open-minded enough, and you know, have some element of enlightenment in your DNA, you're gonna realize that as you grow up anyway, and you get to, you know, late teens, early 20s, and you start to find your identity. You know, at some point you're gonna find out that doing good things, doing things that improve the world a little bit, and I mean a little bit, doesn't have to be a big thing, but just a little, you know. You know, we do three things in this world, right? We learn, we practice our craft, and we teach. Okay, and any day you can do all three of those things in the same day is a good day, you know. And the practicing our craft also means the learning of our craft, and that never stops, you know. And it could be multiple crafts, of course. So I try to emphasize, don't worry about the big stuff, you know. Don't worry about art. Focus on the craft. The art will take care of itself, you know. And the same thing with do something local, do something, you know, once in a while have your band just play a local food bank or something local, and you'll find that it's quite a selfish, you know, quite a self-serving thing to help people, actually, you know. You feel good by doing it. You know, you do it as much for yourself as you're doing it for somebody else. And so, I always tell people, I'm not a nice guy. I'm not some philanthropist. I do things out of completely selfish reasons. You know, I invented two radio stations because, you know, I wanted to hear them on radio, you know. I find, you know, I want the society to be safer and better, which means more education, you know, and we should be treating our teachers the same way we treat our firemen and police and military. You know, they are on the front lines of the war against ignorance. And man, we need that war fought right now more than any other. Okay, because literally half the country is ignorant. I mean, ignorant any way you want to define it, you know. We have to continue to try and reach kids early enough to realize, you know, to have them realize what it means to be an American. We have to bring civics back, you know, into the classroom, first of all, in addition to, you know, that was going to be our second wave of thing. We're trying to integrate civics into the mix also. Because that's been missing, obviously, you know. People don't know how the government works, you know. But the art thing is, you know, there's no wrong answers in art, you know. We ask them, who's your favorite artist? Whatever answer they give is the right answer, you know. And then we say, okay, let's trace them back. Let's see where they come from. Because you have to get students on a common ground. You got to go to them. We the methodology of the school system has always been dragging kids to our own methodology, our own way of doing things. You know, this is the way it's always been done. Learn this now, and someday you'll use it. You know, well, guess what? That ain't working anymore. Okay, that's not going to work. So. Well, let's go to them. Let's go to the kids. They come with gifts. Kids come with gifts. Students come with gifts. They come with imagination built in. They come with energy. They come with, they come with instinct. You know, they come with opinion. They come with four or five, six different gifts that school systems, historically, have suppressed or ignored. Forget all that stuff. Leave all that stuff outside. We're going to teach you this, 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 and this. Well, we feel it's more important to teach a kid how to think than what to think. you know? And so you connect the dots, and the arts does that. And like I said, who's your favorite artist? Beyonce. Well, Beyonce comes from a woman named Aretha Franklin. Mm-hmm. And she comes from Detroit. And we talk about Detroit. And she comes from the gospel church. We talk about the gospel church. She was involved in civil rights. We talk about civil rights. And the kids are there with you. And they're listening. And why? Because it's on their turf. You know, we went to them and let them know that this is something that impacts their life now. And let them enjoy Beyonce a little bit more, because now you know where she comes from, you know. And so suddenly the knowledge becomes richer. Their favorite song becomes meaningful, more meaningful, you know. So all that stuff is integrated into our system now, and it's working very well.
I really appreciated that thoughtful response to my question, because your book towards the end does go into your ideas about political and social issues that are current, and also you addressed a lot of music analysis that you cover upon in the book. There's so much in this book, and it's absolutely fun and entertaining, and there's so much we didn't cover today. So my last question for you is, I've been living in Chicago for about 12 years now, so I got to know, do you have a great story about your time in Chicago?
Well, Chicago is one of the, you know, holy cities of my religion being rock and roll. And of course, Chicago is the blues stuff that I grew up with. So my first trip to Chicago, I went to the South Side of Chicago and went to the blues clubs. There were still quite a few back then. And, I got up and played, I think, at Buddy Guy's place I forget now the names of them. That was a thrill just to see those blues clubs and 2120 South Michigan Avenue, right? Was where Chess was, and then of course the other side of me, I was excited to get to Jilly's, which, you know, my Italian American side of me, which, you know, Jilly's was a bar owner, ended up a bar owner, friend of Frank Sinatra's, who had a famous place in New York, and then they opened a place in Chicago. I don't know if it's still there. Probably not. It was exciting to come to the town of Robin and the Seven Hoods, you know, was featured, you know, and I would use my kind of town in Lillehammer, this TV show I did in Norway. I adapted it to my character would sing that song in a Lilyhammer episode. So it was, you know, Chicago was a very, very special place for me. Just to literally, it is the home of the blues, as far as I'm concerned. You know, my favorite, you know, all my favorite stuff was the Chess stuff, and you know, Muddy and Little Walter and Alan Wolf and all that stuff. So it was thrilling, and it always has been a special place to me.
It's a fantastic city, great music history. And just to let you know, the Chess building is now, it's currently the Willie Dixon Blues Heaven Foundation. So the building is still active as a blues museum.
Excellent.
Namesake of Willie Dixon. So next time you're in Chicago, it's worth a visit. Very cool place.
That's a good idea. Good idea. For those that don't know, Willie Dixon wrote the entire blues songbook. Okay, and I am not exaggerating. There's the American songbook, and there's the blues songbook. Well, Willie Dixon single-handedly wrote it. I mean, it's amazing how important Willie Dixon was. He worked for Chess, for the Chess Brothers, and was a session bass player, but more than that, he He wrote the all the blues songs that you know. He wrote. So I'm glad they did that.
Stevie, thank you so much for joining me today. This has been a great conversation, and your book is wonderful, and it's coming out in paperback. So congratulations.
Thank you. Yes. I don't know when, but soon.
My name is Bradley Morgan, and you've been listening to New Books in Music with my guest today, Stevie Van Zandt. His book is Unrequited Infatuations and is published by Hachette Books. Thank you.